Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So now we go to the 10th sutta in these first 10 suttas, and the week afterwards we'll go through number 1. So this is the Satipatthana Sutta, and you always give it a nice spin just to make sure that you think you've heard it before, but there's always some more things you've never heard before than here first of all. So Satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness. And I think a lot of people have studied this sutta, and the Sanskrit version has Satipupatthana, so it is actually the establishing of mindfulness rather than foundations, but that's only a small point. So here we go, that's have I heard. On one occasion, a blessed one was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasadamma. Anyone know where that is?
Delhi, isn't it?
Yeah, just south of Delhi. Just not quite up to as far as Delhi, but just around that region. So that was actually almost the border areas of where the Buddha went to teach. It wasn't his heartland, but it was on the edges there. Then he addressed the monks thus. Monks, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One said this. Monks, this is the direct path for... comment on this afterwards. This is the direct path to the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, monks, a monk abides contemplating the body as body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And of course there are some problems with that translation, but first of all, the direct path, that's a good translation. And some people, I think it's quite mischievous, they should really know better, when some people say the only path, and that is really mischievous, because the Pali word is ekayana, and ekayana appears only one other place in the whole of the suttas, and that is in, I think, number 13, the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta. Now, see if I can find where it actually is. Let's was it Chura? Sorry, was it Chura Sionada Sutta? Okay, yeah. Okay, it's in the Maha Sionada Sutta, number 12. Okay, so if you go to page 170, for example. Here we go. He says, by number, paragraph 37. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that on a dissolution of the body after death, he will appear in a state of deprivation and unhappy destination and perdition in hell. And then later on, with the divine eye, which is purified as a process, you must see that on a dissolution of the body after death, he has to reappear in a state of deprivation, after his destination, in perdition, in hell, experience exclusively painful, recognizing feeling. Suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty. Here we go. Came by an ekayana magga, a path going in one way only, and directed to that same charcoal pit. Then a man with good sight and seeing will say, this person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that he will come to the same charcoal pit. And then later on he sees that he has fallen in that same charcoal pit and is experiencing excruciatingly painful, racking, piercing feelings. So that's how he sees, the Buddha sees. He sees people doing certain karma, you know that this is where it's going to end. And it's similarly here, a path which is, has to lead to that charcoal pit. Can't go any other destination. No left turn, no right turn. It's a direct path, goes in one direction. And you can see from that, so that's the only other time where it said a path going in one way only. This is the Ekayana Magga. And this is exactly the same word as used in the Satipatthana, the only other place which is used after other than the Satipatthana. So many people say that this is a path, if you keep following it, has to lead to Nibbana. There's no left, there's no right, it's a direct path. The only path is a very, again, pernicious translation, because it doesn't really mean that at all. So, the question is, what is the only path? Yes, because that's said in the Magga Wagga of the Dhammapada, Eso wa Maggo Nati Anyo Dasanasa Visuddhiya. And it's referring to the Eightfold Path, it was in the Gatha beforehand. And it literally means Eta, this, referred to the Eightfold Path. Wa is a shortened form of Iwa, means certainly. What is it? Eso wa Maggo, this. So, Iwa means the only sort of. Eso Iwa Maggo, this only path. And to make it clear, Nati Anyo, there is not another. Dasanasa Visuddhiya, for the purification of vision or insight, the Eightfold Path. And that's always needs to be kept in mind. The Eightfold Path is the only path. So, when it says, anyone who says the only path here, come on guys. You know, that's, you should know better than that. Direct path is a pretty good translation there. For the purification of being, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nirvana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. Now what are the four? Here monks, a monk abides, contemplating the body as body. And I think you've heard me say this before. That's a bad translation. When you are translating, you don't translate word by word, you translate the unit of concept, which is a thought, which is a phrase. And what that means is not contemplating the body as body, it just means contemplating the body. It's just an idiom, it's a peculiarity of Pali, that when you have a verb and a object, sometimes it's repeated. For example, you do path sweeping of paths. You window clean windows. You dishwash dishes. You body reflect bodies. So this is just a peculiarity of the language. Now, when you read this stuff in Pali, you know, the suttas, you read and read and read and read, then it gets quite clear because you get used to the language. And as you get used to the language, you see this particular type of construction, which is peculiar to the Pali, comes again and again and again, and soon the light bulb goes on in your brain and says, there's nothing special here, it just means contemplating the body. And if you are saying as what the meaning actually is and translating the meaning rather than the words, it just means contemplating the body, contemplating feelings, contemplating mind objects, and that's all it is. Nothing more than that. And I say that, because I remember as a young man, we get arguments. What does he mean, contemplating the body as the body, or contemplating the body in the body? And there was so much thought went into that, and when you learn Pali, you say, what a waste of time. All it meant was contemplating the body. Nice and simple. Ardent. Fully aware, that's Sampajanya. Mindful, Satima, as you have in mindfulness. Now the next phrase is my favorite. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now that particular phrase, I know its history because it first appeared by Professor Rhys Davids when he did one of the first translations of the Satipatthana Sutta. Professor Rice Davies was about 150 years ago. He has actually done a lot of very good work. But it's not accurate. Because what does covetousness for the world actually mean? And put away grief, is that all? So you don't. Grief is a word which we use when we've lost a loved one. Is that really what it means? And again, looking at Pali, you know these words. First of all, the so-called here, covetousness from the world is loke abhija. And so-called grief here is domanasa, which means bad mind. And when I started looking through the Pali, I came across loke abhija many times, and even domanasa in another context. And you know what that context is? What's loke abhija? You heard me before? It's a synonym for Kama Chanda, the first hindrance. Especially if you go through the Anguttara Nikaya, the five hindrances in Pali, number one, loke abhija. Usually Vyapada, Tilamita, Uchicca, Kukicca, and that, Uchicca. Sometimes they use Kama Chanda, sometimes loke abhija. And this is not just two or three times, 50, 60 times. Remember going through them and seeing it. And it became so clear that loke abhija is a synonym for Kama Chanda. Means the same thing. Sometimes in the five hindrances they use one word, sometimes the other word. So it's very clear that means the first hindrance. Not covetous for the world, but having put aside the first hindrance of the five hindrances. Very clear. And the grief, the domanasa, in two places in the suttas. One in the Hina Majjhima and also in the Sutta Nipata. The second hindrance is domanasa. Instead of Vyapada, they've used domanasa in that list. So seeing that, that means the two hindrances. The first of the two five hindrances. And surprise, surprise, when you look in the notes in the back, where we've got note 138, if you've got your book there, what does it say? From the commentary, sometimes the commentary gets it right. Let's see. Okay, it's very end there. The bottom there. Covetousness and grief. It's the last line on page 1189. Covetousness and grief, the commentary says, MA is the Majjhima commentary, stands for sensual desire and ill will, the principal hindrances that must be overcome for the practice to succeed. So it does mean the two hindrances. The commentary recognizes that. And in the commentary continues, it's not mentioned here, recognizing another idiom in Pali, which is that when there is a group of qualities, mentioning the first two is supposed to include all the others in that well-known group. So in other words, for those of you old enough to remember the Beatles, John, Paul, Ringo and George, in Pali just called John and Paul, and the other two would be understood to be included. It's just another idiom, and that is also people who know their Pali have seen that many times, and that's there in the text. And so the commentary to the Satipatthana Sutta here in the Majjhima Nikaya and also in the Digha Nikaya, there's the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, says by mentioning the first two of these well-known lists, it also includes the other three. So the commentary said the meaning of covetousness and grief for the world means the five hindrances. And that actually changes a lot of one's understanding of the Satipatthana. Because now it becomes, and if this is legitimate, it's not just Ajahn Brahm, it's legitimate, even if it was Ajahn Brahm, still legitimate. This is legit. So you say, what are the poor? Here monks and monk abides, contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. And that makes the Satipatthana much more interesting. He applies contemplating feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. He applies contemplating mind, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. He abides contemplating mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. How do you put away the five hindrances? Basically, Eightfold Path. So you can't get away from the Eightfold Path, that's where it's included. Mindfulness is important, but also putting away the five hindrances. And the most important way of putting away the five hindrances is the jhanas. That's why you can't separate out Satipatthana from the jhana practices. If you want to see that, that's over in Nalakapana. Goodness me, some months ago. Where it. I'll remember it once. One of the suttas where it says quite clearly that without attaining the jhanas, the five hindrances invade the mind and remain. So it makes it quite clear. I'll get that in a moment. Just slip my mind here. But that will actually show you that the practice of the jhanas, which is based on the Eightfold Path, is necessary in order to abandon the five hindrances. So that's the Satipatthana in brief. Contemplating body, feelings, mind and mind objects, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away the five hindrances. That's how we do Satipatthana. If you look at Nalakapana Sutta, those of you who are on page 567, my mind was working, but I doubted it. Page 567, Nalakapana, paragraph 6. What should be done, Anuruddha, by a clansman who has gone forth thus? While he still does not attain to that rapture and pleasure that are secluded from sensual pleasure and secluded from unwholesome states, that's the first jhana, obviously, or to something more peaceful than that, the second jhana above, covetousness invades his mind and remains, ill will invades his mind and remains, sloth and torpor invade his mind and remains, restlessness and remorse invade his mind and remains, doubt invades his mind and remains. Those are the five hindrances, and you can see there with the covetousness, avijja is number one in the example, together with discontent and weariness. That is so while you don't attain to the first jhana or above. But when you attain to the first jhana above, then the five hindrances together with discontent and weariness do not invade your mind and remain. So it's a very clear saying of the Buddha there that without the jhanas, these hindrances keep coming in. So, any questions on that?
Yeah, could you draw it and say it's like a feedback loop? So first you practice the Satipatthana, then you get the jhanas from the practice, and then the Satipatthana really starts to work.
Yeah, it does. But there's an interesting thing here that at the very end of the Satipatthana Sutta, and actually in this one was in the Mahasatipatthana, yeah. And at the end of this one here, in both of them, on page 155, just going ahead here. Let alone half a month, months, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for them. Either final knowledge here and now, that's arahat, or if there's a trace of thinking left, non-return. I always remember that one, because the first time I read this book, I was still a student, I read the Satipatthana, and it was actually Bhikkhu Soma's translation. And at the introduction there, he said that he'd gone to Burma to practice the Satipatthana, and that he'd been there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and he still wasn't enlightened. And he was wondering what the heck's gone wrong, because the Buddha said, if you do this for 7 days, you'll be enlightened. So he said, well, obviously I've got it wrong, but I'll write a book about it instead. And that's what I remember seeing. But the important thing is, in such a way for 7 days. The reason why he didn't get enlightened, he wasn't doing it in such a way. And the thing that they were missing, putting away the five hindrances. If you put away the five hindrances for 7 whole days, and then you contemplate the Satipatthana, then I think what the Buddha said would be true. So that was a mistake, not putting away the five hindrances. Yeah? If a person has really got their five hindrances out of the way, they say in 7 days that's for the slow coaches. The whiz kids, sort of the whiz girls. They just go in the evening.
But they have practiced in the previous life?
Probably, yeah. I mean, the hindrances are totally gone. So, yeah, go on.
So, emerging from the jhana, the hindrances are still suppressed. No?
They're suppressed.
And it depends how deep the jhana was,
how long
it was.
Indeed,
passed.
Yes. But that's your window of opportunity. Mm. And there's another sutra, I'm not going to mention it here, the simile of the cook. And there it says that when you do Satipatthana, if one hindrance is coming up, you go and do some samatha, get into some jhana. Mm. And then just suppress the hindrances again, and then go back to the contemplation. Because as long as there's hindrance is there, you're not going to see things as they truly are. You're going to see them as you want them to be. And that's the problem. So, those are the things in brief. Now what are they in detail? Number one, the contemplation of the body. And it's good, at last he's put contemplation of the body instead of contemplation of the body as a body. So the title is good. And how does a person, not a monk anymore, abide contemplating the body? Here, a meditator goes to the forest or to the root of a tree, and not to an empty hut, it's an empty place. Sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and establish not mindfulness in front of him. That's again a bad translation, you haven't said this before. Having made mindfulness a priority. Putting something in front is giving it priority. It's an idiom again, which means it's important. Ever mindful, you breathe in, mindful, you breathe out. Breathing in long, you understand, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, you understand, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you understand, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, you understand, I breathe out short. He trains us. I shall breathe in, experience the whole body. I shall breathe out, experience the whole body. That's what it says, but again, in the Anapanasati Sutta, again, it makes it very clear that the body is literally the body of the breath, not the physical body. You have a body of soldiers. You have a body of evidence. You have like a body of many, many things. The word kaya in Pali sometimes can mean the physical body. But in other times it means they even got the dharmakaya, the body of dharma, namakaya, the body of mental qualities. It just means a group of things. And the Buddha says in Anapanasati Sutta, the breath is a body amongst bodies. Let's get up to it. And that's 118. I'll show you. So you know where we're getting all this from. 118, mindfulness of breathing. Fulfilling the four foundations of mindfulness. Monks, on whatever occasion a monk breathing in long understands I breathe in long, or breathing out long understands I breathe out long. This is page 944 on the bottom, page 945. Special 945. You've got that? Page 945, yeah. It goes through the four first parts of Anapanasati. It says on line number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware, and mindless, having put away the five hindrances. I say that this is a certain body amongst the bodies, namely in and out breathing. So this is saying quite clearly that the breath is considered to be a group of things as a body. So So when it says contemplating the body, the whole body here, it means contemplating the whole in and out breath. And what that means in practice, you breathe in, you breathe out, and then this third stage of anapanasati, from the very beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath. When the in-breath finishes, that space before the out-breath begins, the beginning of the out-breath to the very end of the out-breath. Your mindfulness is continuous throughout. You see the whole of the breath. So when it says the whole body here, it doesn't mean that you can experience the toes and the ears and the nose and everything at the same time. You're actually experiencing just the breath in any kind of body. So that's what it means by experiencing the whole body. I should breathe out experiencing the whole body. I should breathe in tranquilizing the body formation, the kaya sankhara, which again is the breath. So you're knowing the whole breath and then you're calming it down. Just as a skilled lathe operator or apprentice when making a long turn understands how to make a long turn, a short turn understands how to make a short turn, so too breathing in long, you understand all these things. In other words, the first of the satipatthanas, contemplating the body, can be done just by doing the breath meditation. And the lathe thing, when I was in Thailand 35 years ago, we'd make much of our requisites, like umbrellas. And we learned how to use the lathe. And the lathe, there was a big long bamboo stick, one end was attached to the ground, and the other one was a long bendy stick, and they'd tie a rope to the end, and the other end of the rope was wound around the piece of wood you were carving, and put onto a treadle. And you push a treadle down, and that would pull the rope and turn the thing. And then you release it, and the bamboo would actually swing up. And then you push it down again. So the string would actually wind around a piece of wood and would turn it. And it would go up again and turn it again. And it would go up again and turn it again. The bendy bamboo. So it would go up, this is the bamboo, and this is the piece of string, and that would be wound around something. So as you pulled it, the piece of wood would wind up, go around, you let go of the treadle, it would go up, pull down, up. So that up and down, wound around a piece of wood on two nails to make it turn, would go around. And then you, with a knife, you'd actually carve it. And that's how the original lathes were like. You used to use those ones. So anyway, they can understand, make a long turn or a short turn, that type of lathe explains that simile. Now, please take away these subheadings here, because they're not in the original Pali. So it calls it insight here. But anyway, in this way you apply contemplating the body internally, or by contemplating the body as externally, or by contemplating the body both internally and externally. Or else you apply contemplating the body in its native arising, or contemplating the body in its vanishing, or contemplate the body in its nature both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindfulness that there is body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one abides contemplating the body. Number one, as monks like Ajahn Sujata and Anālayo have shown by being very, very good with their scholarship and willing to abandon any sacred cows, who show in the very earliest of the Satipatthana Suttas, this passage here stops at contemplating the body internally, externally, or both internally and externally. And this other stuff seems to have been added on later. The original part of the Satipatthana is just contemplation of the body in this way, internally, externally, or both. Externally means just as you breathe, I breathe. There's nothing special with me. Just breath, that's all. Yeah?
The last one seems to be the internal.
Internally and externally?
No, just in life or just in life.
Well, that wasn't in the original.
Yeah.
So that's been added. which is interesting. Now, however, but it's here now, it's fine. So, internally and externally, just the body, eventually feelings, mind objects. Basically, so you're not something special, just we're all the same, in the same degree, the way we work. That's what that one means. For in its nature arising, passing, arising and passing, what does that mean? In the Satipatthana, seeing the arising and passing away. It's not what you expect. Because... Yeah, no, it's interesting, the Satipatthana, it's the two Satipatthana suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya, is also in the same yuta. There's a whole series of suttas on the Satipatthana Sanyutta. And the interesting one is number 42, it's called Origination. This is the Samudaya and Atagama. What is here translated as arising and vanishing? Monks, I will teach you the origination of passing away, the four Satipatthanas. Listen to this. So what they have translated here as arising and vanishing, here they have as origination and passing away. Now what monks is, I have here the arising of the body, with the arising of nutriment, there is the arising of the body. With the cessation of nutriment, there is a cessation of the body. And last week I told you what the nutriments are, the four nutriments. For the sustaining of a body already alive, or for the sustaining of a body about to come to be. Remember those four nutriments? Number one was?
Come on.
Food?
Food.
That's right, yeah, but what's all that in English? Food is number one. Contact is number two. Number three, will, yes. And consciousness, number four. But when those four are there, then comes a body. And without that, it ceases. So actually seeing the arising and vanishing is actually not seeing sort of body sort of come into existence and pass away again. It's seeing why it comes into existence. And why it can cease. It's seeing the causes. So when you have the Satipatthana, you abide contemplating the body and its nature arising. What is meant there? Very certain from this Satipatthana Sanghita, you see the cause of its arising. No, you've got the four nutriments. That's the cause, which is said here. You know, you understand, contemplating the body's nature of vanishing means you see the four nutriments cease, the body ceases. Classic Buddhist idea of cause and effect. And that's really important when it comes to things like Vedana. You see the causes. Let's go further. In the Satipatthana Sanghita. So what monks is the arising of the body and its vanishing. With the arising of nutriments, there's the arising of the body. With the vanishing of nutriments, there's the vanishing of the body. With the arising of contact, there's the arising of feeling, of Vedana. With the cessation of contact, there's the cessation passing away, or the cessation of Vedana. So that's actually when you, later on we come to the watching the arising and the vanishing of Vedana. That's what it means, to see that with contact this Vedana happens. Without the contact it passes away. Contact is a special word, it just means a sensory object. The sensory object meets the sense base. They come together, consciousness arises. It's basically the sense base is turning on. Now later on, when you get to the third Satipatthana of contemplating the arising and vanishing of consciousness or mind, with the arising of nama-rupa, name and form, there is the arising of citta. With the cessation of nama-rupa, there's a cessation of jitta. So when we're doing the mind contemplation, it's arising and passing away. It's actually seeing with nama-rupa, which I've actually translated, it's a rough translation, but it's useful, objects of mind. When those things arise, then mind arises. When those things cease, mind ceases. We go back later on the simile of the two sheaves of leaves, consciousness and nama rupa leaning on one another. When one goes, the other one goes. That thing arising and passing away of citta. I'll go back to this when we get to that third satipatthana. And an interesting one for the seeing the arising and vanishing of the last satipatthana, dhamma. With the arising of attention, manasikara, there is the arising of dhamma. With the cessation of attention, there is the cessation of dhamma. That's what it means in contemplating the dhamma in its arising, vanishing, or both in its arising and vanishing. According to the Satipatthana Samyutta. Yes, again, I think it was Ajahn Sujata who put me onto that one. So it gives another meaning to what arising and vanishing is. So that's the second part. And the third part, what else? You say the easy one. Well, mindfulness is established.
Sorry.
A mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. What the heck does that mean? Mindfulness is there, there is a body, just the extent necessary for mindfulness. It seems to be a circular thing there. Mindfulness is there just to be mindful. Now, the important part of that is there is a body. It always says actually just body in the Pali. In other words, there is mindfulness that body. And I like to add the English word just body. It's just body, that's all. It's just body. There's a body. Big deal. Establishing necessary for the bare knowledge of mindfulness, the bare knowledge of mindfulness. To put that into the context of the rest of the teachings, I would translate that as mindfulness is just a body, not my body, not me, not a self. That's the whole purpose of this third part. Mindfulness is just not me, not mine, not a self, it's just body. Mindfulness is just feelings, bathing it, not me, not mine, not a self. It's just citta. Not me, I'm not the consciousness. Not mine, it's not my consciousness, it's not a self, it's mine. That's the whole purpose of this. So when it says mindfulness is just a body, it means exactly what is this body? And especially seeing not me, not mine, not a self. Because that is what's necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness so that you can abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. In particular here, not clinging to the body. And not clinging to the body means not taking between me, mine, and self. That's the meaning there of those three. Actually, those three, for the last one, abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world, means that you've just seen. See them what they are, see them in their cause, and when the cause is gone, they go. So it can't be anything permanent, it can't be a self, it can't be something substantial. Or you simply know it's just body, it's not me, not mine, or self. And that way you are independent of the body. Body gets sick, body gets old, body gets ugly. You get a cancer, you get a tumour. So what? It's just body, that's all. Nothing to do with mental. Look after it, if you don't worry too much about it. Questions? Is that okay? Okay, here you go. Another way of doing the body contemplation. Now with each one of these, it hasn't been stated in here, but it's understood, abbreviated, that each one of these, that you abide having ardent, fully aware and mindful, having putting away the five hindrances, then when walking, a monk understands I'm walking, standing, I understand I'm standing, sitting, you understand I'm sitting, lying down, you understand you're lying down, you understand accordingly however your body is disposed. So having put away the five hindrances, you can just watch the body just in its different postures. Here are the four postures. Are there anything other than the four postures? Yeah, but I mean, there's other postures as well as those. There was a story of a monk who was so weak. He was been practicing very hard, and it was a famine, and he was so weak, a lay person saw him and decided to carry him to get a meal. And he was over the shoulder of this lay person, being carried back to his house to give him some feed. He was that weak. And while he was on the shoulder, he actually got enlightened. And they said that that was none of the four postures. He wasn't really lying down, he wasn't walking, he wasn't standing, he wasn't sitting. He was draped over a person's shoulder. So the four postures are just examples. There's other things other than those four postures. But it just shows wherever your posture is, you know what you're doing. Yeah, he wasn't lying down, he wasn't standing up, he was halfway in between. So there's another sort of posture there. So the four postures are not exclusive, they're indicative. And again, it's just a way of seeing this body, and again, seeing the cause of the body. As we say here, it's cessation, or just watching it, just body doing its thing. And that's what that one means. And again, the next one, sampajana, full awareness. And again, having put aside the five hindrances, ardent, mindful, fully aware. A monk is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, keeping silent. Now there's one thing, or two words here, which again are badly translated. And this is an important thing. If ever you translate something, please be honest with the word and don't translate what you think it should be. Because the word here for falling asleep and waking up actually very clearly means being asleep and being awake. Falling asleep is a totally different Pali word. Here the word translated as falling asleep is sutang. Falling asleep is nidang okamana. The verb is nidang okamati, you descend into nidang. That's actually falling asleep. Being asleep here is what's actually here. And waking up is jagara. Jagara is actually being awake. And so people translating think, how can you be mindful when you're asleep? It doesn't make sense. So the translators have put mindful falling asleep and mindful waking up. And that's confused a lot of people. So a lot of times people, you try, when you're going to sleep, you've got to be mindful. You've got to be mindful as well falling asleep. You're never going to sleep that way. And when you wake up, it's natural when you wake up, first of all, to have low mindfulness before the mindfulness actually gets going. It's just a brain thing, the brain hasn't turned on yet. It's nothing to do with you, or your abilities, or lack of abilities, it's a physical thing. So what can it actually mean here? It actually means being mindful of sleep. What does that mean? Does it mean that you have to be really aware in your dream, have what they call lucid dreaming? What it actually means is mindfulness is an important point. The mindfulness is in Pali is not always of what is happening now. It's mindful of the purpose of sleep. Mindfulness is actually what it's there for. This mindfulness is giving a different meaning of mindfulness. Very often people think mindfulness is being aware of this moment. Sometimes you're mindful of the Dhamma, you understand what you've learned. So mindfulness of sleep will be mindful of basically the purpose of sleep. What's it there for? You look up the commentary's definition of sampajana, here the full awareness, it's seeing its purpose. And whether what you're doing is achieving that purpose or obstructing that purpose. It's all about why you sleep, why you eat, why you extend your arms, why you are also wearing your robes, why you're drinking, why you're defecating, why you're urinating. Understand also its purpose. This is also included here in full awareness. In the time of the Buddha, sampajanya literally means with wisdom.
Does it mean clear comprehension?
Clear comprehension is usually the translation, but comprehension means not just being aware of what's happening, but with wisdom. Why are you doing it? What's it all about? So it's not just being mindful of eating and just stuffing your body full and overeating. You can be very mindful of putting that extra cake into your mouth. But what are you doing that for? So it's also understanding what you're doing it for, with wisdom. Sam means with, pajanya is an extended word for panya. Yeah.
Isn't that the talking about people
who used to live down with the child? Yeah, that's the investigation, the purpose for finding out what the purpose is. But this is actually knowing the purpose, not the act of discovery. But you see what you've learned.
Is it wise attention?
Wise attention is a different word, but they are related. But this is actually using wisdom. I know that the forest teachers always used, or instead of saying sati sampajanya, they would actually say sati panya. This is the sampajanya here, that in Pali it's always sati sampajanya, but it actually means the same. Again, we know Pali, the word for to know is pajanati. Pajanya is the noun from that. And Pali is always contracted. Instead of pajanya, there's just panya, it's like slurring. And it's the vernacular. So they shorten words whenever they can. So pajanya becomes panya. So sampajanya literally means sampanya, with wisdom. So this is actually what it means here, but with wisdom. When you're acting full awareness when going forward, it's not just you're always aware that you're going forward, it also means you understand why you're going forward. And that makes it quite clear why they say being aware of sleep. Because you aren't aware when you're unconscious. But you are mindful, you're aware of what the purpose of sleep is. So you don't oversleep, you don't undersleep.
So Does the experience like the experience going to sleep all night or single minutes all night? So, seeing that they meditate to sleep, your sleep just is placed in such a bed forever.
Remember, when you're unconscious, you don't know you're unconscious. So sometimes you're aware of breath, and then there's a gap, and then you're aware of the breath again. For you, it's continuous, because that gap in between is not noticed. The men and monks who say that are actually falling asleep. Unconsciousness happens. I don't know, it's a long time since I ever had an operation, when I was about young, had an operation since. But when you have under anesthetic, you don't know when you are. And suddenly you wake up again. You're back there again. I said, is the operation done yet? I said, you've been out for about 10 hours. I said, don't worry about it, because there's a total gap. You don't know the gap's been there. For you, that you've just been given the injection, then you're there again. And hours have gone past in between. So that's the same with some of those monks who say that they're mindful all night. They don't know the gap has happened. There was one of my fourth Rinpoche, one of these monks, he was amazing. When he gave a talk on the Vipassana days, he'd get up and he'd sit. He would talk for about 3 or 4 hours, but we'd always have to be there. This is no joke. He'd fall asleep, because it's a really comfortable chair. Like, we always get the comfortable chairs when you're teaching. Now, if I can lean back, you have to sort of stand up there. So he's giving a talk, and he'd fall asleep. The thing was, though, he would not know he'd fallen asleep. And it's amazing, he'd be given the talk, and then he'd stop, and he'd fall asleep, and then he'd start exactly where he left off with his talk. That mid-sentence, and the sentence actually would be, if you taped it, if you cut out those 5 minutes when he dozed off, and it would like be a continuous talk, it, no one would know he'd fallen asleep. And our problem was, we didn't know how long he was going to fall asleep for. So we couldn't get up and go to the toilet or disappear, because, you know, he just might wake up again. And where are you gone? But it would be a good thing to do. So the thing was, he had no awareness of these gaps in his speech. Okay, that's another way to put awareness. The foulness of the bodily parts. Again, a monk reviews the same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the head, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, that's contents of your stomach. Mesentery is the content of the intestine, sorry. Contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, bleh, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittles, snot. You know, we used to chart this. We tried charting this in English once, just like you. But we came to snot. Everyone burst out laughing. We couldn't chart it anymore, so after that time we always charted this one in Pali. You don't laugh then. Order the joints and urine. What's that called? The
31, 31, 31.
Oh, you're too smart.
Where's the brain?
We always heard, and I got Pramada on this morning, we always heard that 32 parts of the body. But actually if you count them, there's only 31 here. And actually the commentary added the brain as number 32.
So, where's the brain in there? I mean, it
must have
been a bed.
Yeah,
it's a brain in
there. No brain. Bone marrow. It's called bone marrow. They thought it was bone marrow. Instead of bone marrow. They thought the brain was the tip of the here.
Yeah.
So that was just bone marrow. Never understood what the brain was all about. Well, even though there was brain surgery at that time. Anyway, so 31 parts of the body. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends. That's one end, that's the other end. Full of, it's a great simile, a bag with two openings. Full of many sorts of, just as though there were a bag with open both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice. And a man with the good eyes were to open it and reveal it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, these are millet. This is white rice. So a monk reviews the same body at just the 31 parts. In this way, if I was contemplating the body internally, externally, both internally and externally, and you can see in these ones the full awareness, the four postures, and especially the foulness of the body, and the other one, you can see why when someone like Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Brahmadi is really into this as well, that this really, the seeing it internally, externally, or both internally and externally, was probably the original. And it applies to the foulness, full awareness, four postures. It doesn't really apply, the arising and vanishing doesn't really apply to these particular ways of doing Satipatthana. There's a good argument there. The original was just the arising, so we just see contemplating internally, externally, or both. Original. But it doesn't matter, the other ones are very useful for other parts of the Satipatthana.
Sorry, Bhante, I was listening to Ajahn Don, and he has really mastered a lot of these contemplations, particularly the body parts.
Yeah.
And also, he also did the elements.
Yeah.
And when he talks about it, he talks about it that he has mastered it to the point of where that practice basically vanishes. And, you know, he couldn't do the body parts after a certain time, and then he was doing the elements, and then he would master that element to the point of where it was just void, and his contemplation was only on void. I don't know if it means in that sense it disappears at some stage with such mastery.
But actually this is one of the purposes of doing body contemplation. And this is actually the pre-jhana one. Now, I often say that the Satipatthana is the pre-jhana Satipatthana and post-jhana Satipatthana. I think there's a sutta in the Anguttara which implies that. And I thought, yeah, right on. And the pre-jhana Satipatthana is doing these things so you can let go of the body. You can see it's just the 31 parts of the body. It's just a body. If you can do that, it means these things do vanish. And then one of the problems when you're sitting meditation is aches in the body, sounds or whatever. This is all to do with the body. And it's very difficult for people to let go of the body and with it the five senses. And you know that once that is done, you've let go of the body and the five senses have been subdued, then you know, you're on the edge of the jhanas. That's one of the reasons for the jhanas. Vivicheva kamehi, apart, separated, having let go of the five senses and with it the body. This is one of its great purposes. So by contemplating these things, if the 31 parts disappears, your body disappears, the elements disappears, and it's void, you're on the edge of the jhanas. One of its purposes is to cut away that identification with the body which stops you letting go. I've often sort of contemplated not just how to let go, but why can't people let go? Why can't you sort of you stop listening to things? What have to do with you? The sound of the heaters. What's that got to do with you? Why can't you just say I'm not going to listen to that? Even your body, you know, it's always going to cause you pain. So can't you just say, body, I'm going to turn you off, I'm not going to even feel you anymore. It's easy to do that with your eyes, you just close them, you can't see anything anymore. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have that same switch for your body? Maybe experiencing pain or hunger or cold, just flip the switch so you can't feel that. You can actually do the same with your eyes, turn the switch so you can't hear things. Why can't we do that? The way we have to do that is part of the reason for doing the Satipatthana Pijana. So you just take out the body. The reason we can't do it, we are actually attached to this body. We just cannot let it go.
What
about the earplugs? Then you hear this ringing in your ears. Yeah, but it should disappear.
What if you just listen to it as a meditation?
But again, the whole purpose is to listen to it for the purpose of allowing it to disappear. So as you were saying, you know, with the Ajahn Dhan simile, to know these things for the purpose of seeing them vanish.
Just a comment that what he said, if he would like them, that feeling would be a pain for the blind because they can't hear and see.
Yeah, but they can't hear and see all the time. Without that contact, they die. So you need the contact, the sensory experience, to survive. But you need to be able to let it go from time to time to get over blind. And eventually, to let it go completely, so you do die.
Now, yes, later on in the Satipatthana, and I agree with you on your interpretation of this whole thing of the two, I like that interpretation, two different stages. There's one there where you try and understand.
Yeah, good, yeah.
So you understand enough, and then the mind is worked up.
Exactly. Wisdom.
You have to understand it.
Correct.
You know, that causes and conditions for your life.
Yeah, because without that understanding, you won't be able to let go. That's why I always say the saying, Yati jhana makanyasa. There is no jhana without wisdom.
Yeah, wisdom that Dhamma Bhavati.
Dhamma Bhavati. One of my favorite sayings, verse 372. I remember the number. It's one of my favorite ones. So, how does the wisdom? It's wisdom power which leads to meditation. All of you who strive and struggle and put force into it, missing the meaning of that saying. There is no jhana without wisdom. Never say there's no jhana without striving. There's no jhana without wisdom. Wisdom, 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 wisdom. So if you do contemplate these things and wisdom arises, stillness happens. You get into a state of flow. The elements.
Just want to talk about the word in impurities, if that's the translation you would use also.
True, it's asuchi. And it is actually that, especially that was also done for monks or nuns who had lust. And when you have a lust, oh, you've got such beautiful hair. Oh, you know, you've just got wonderful eyes. And there was that great story of the nun. What was her name again? And she was chased in the forest by this young man. No, but anyway, it was. But anyway, she was chased in the forest by this young man, and she tried to escape, but you know she couldn't. And the young man said, "What are you a nun for? You should go be my wife. You're just so beautiful. I don't want to be a monk, a nun." He said, "Oh, don't do that. You're wasting. You're such a lovely girl. You're beautiful. What do you like about me then? What's so beautiful about this ugly body?" He said, "Your eyes. You've got such beautiful eyes. I love your eyes." So she said, "You love my eyes, eh?" So she took one out and gave it to him. She plucked out her own eye. And when he saw it all bloody, he didn't like it anymore. And he went away. He wasn't interested in falling in love with a one eye. None. It's true, it's one of the stories.
She's an arahant.
Oh, she's an arahant, yeah, super. Yeah. That's what they say, it's always a happy ending. That she went, you know, sort of one eye to the Buddha, and the Buddha saw her use his psychic powers, and she had two eyes again. But she's supposed to have taken out her own eye. And that was actually a lovely thing. Why do people love eyes? If she did take one eye, it's not beautiful anymore, is it? You reckon? Look, when I was a teacher, I was being a student teacher, teaching physics. One of the lessons I had to do was actually showing just optics, and so that the human eye, just how it's got a lens. And actually when you see something on the retina, it's actually inverted. It's upside down. So I had to teach this to kids, and what are you supposed to do? I was a vegetarian at the time, I had to go to the butcher shop, this was in the town of Durham, and order in like 6 bullseyes, because they'd be slaughtering the cows here, and you get these big bullseyes. And so, I was in the lesson, I had these big bullseyes, and it was interesting, you could actually cut them up, and actually you can see in the back of the eye, the image inverted, the lens, and it was a very wonderful lesson. The trouble was, at the end of the lesson, I was a student teacher, I had to collect the eyes up. And 2 were missing. I could only collect up 4. And apparently what had happened is 13 or 14 year old boys had taken these two eyes, and in the playground they got up to go and trying to get the girl. Had a great time with these eyes. So I'll let you know, they're very scary. So when you say what's wrong with these eyes, they're actually ugly when they're taking out the socket. Anyway,
do you really need to perceive the body as ugly?
If you have lust, it's helpful. But if you get too far into that, you just get into this weird negativity. The whole purpose of this is balance. If you're leaning too far to the left, you're going to go to the right. Too far to the right, you're going to lean to the left.
If
any of you Anagarikas see like a beautiful girl coming to the monastery, a young, beautiful, lovely lady, because people actually dress up when they come to monasteries, and you see a beautiful, it's so wonderful, so lovely, oh yes, what am I an Anagarika for? Then what I do, when I was very young, I told the other monks, look for her pimples, her bad teeth, or anything which is part of the impurity. And you know, do that to a boy as well, because all that does, it takes away this fantasy. It's beautiful, even though her bones are beautiful. I love everything about you, my dear. Really? Even what comes out of my anus, do you love that too? I love you through and through. Of course you don't. But you don't think about that when you have lust. So the whole idea is actually to get real and just to have a balance. So the asuka is there to get a balance. Well, yeah, four elements were everywhere, the four elements, somewhere around here. How the 40 parts? Four elements. A monk reviews his same body, however displaced, however disposed, by way of elements. And this body is the earth, water, fire, and air element, that's all. Just as a skilled butcher's apprentice had killed a cow and seated at the crossroads that cut up into pieces, so a monk cuts up the body into these, you know, four elements, that's all. And this body is just the earth, water, fire, and air element. And these days, if you had some biology, you can cut it up into sort of the bones and the cells or whatever else you want to cut it up into. It's just one way amongst others of just working in the body, cutting up. So when you see it, it's just formed of all this compounded stuff. You don't take it to be me, mine, or self. It's just a body, that's all. And the nine charnel ground contemplations.
Sorry, Bhante, can I ask, this element isn't a reflective, it's not particularly, it's not, it can be either samatha or vipassana practice, like
there is
it's really big on
no difference between samatha and vipassana. But the elements, it's just one way amongst many of actually analysing something into its parts and thereby to seeing that the illusion of a self or continuity of happiness is abandoned. Especially with the body, your body internally, externally, other people's body. This material, four elements. I had a lot of trouble with four elements when I first came across it. I was a physicist. What do you mean four elements? That's such basic. We've got a long way since then. We have the protons, the electrons, the forces of nature. However, it's good enough. It's just one way amongst many of analysing the body. But as a physicist, I said, I'll analyse the body. There's no atoms, there's molecules, there's
quarks,
cells. Sorry?
The quarks
as well, yeah.
Quarks.
Yeah, all it is quarks coming together, that's all. And passing away again. That's all it is.
No, but I mean, this can be viewed in a samatha way, that you conceptually view that everything is the elements, or that you experientially, you experience the stiffness, the hardness, and the roughness, and the solidity.
Either way eventually leads to the other way.
Yeah.
To be this way becomes a way of seeing. And insight always leads to calm. If you see things they truly are, it solves all the problems, you become very still. If you're very still, you see this is true. So the two actually, again, like sheaves of reeds again, the past and samatha, they live against each other.
So, leads me to a question about the sutra and Buddha in fact.
Yeah.
It comes, you know, there's the four ways.
The four ways.
Talks about the four ways of enlightenment.
Yeah.
You say it's that quick. It's not like a practice.
And the four
you
ways.
Insight, with meaning.
Correct, yeah.
Proceeding, tranquility, proceeding, insight.
All working together. Mm-hmm. It's the simile Ajahn Chah would use. Here is the front of my hand leading the back of my hand. Here is the back of my hand leading the front of my hand. Is in both just about together. They all travel together. One may be in the front, the other one's right behind. One might be right behind, the other one's right in front. So it's not as if you do insight and no samatha, and then you do samatha and no insight. They always go together. One goes in front, but you don't do one and not the other. It's samatha proceeding with pasana, with pasana proceeding samatha, samatha with pasana together. And the fourth one is not just with pasana, it's not just samatha. There is a weird one. It usually is said that by listening to a great teaching or some contemplation or whatever, you get inspired, the five tendencies are overcome, and you see the Dhamma. And that's always the path of streaming. Having experienced the path, then you make much of that path, you practice the path. And that part of that sutra is where you practice the path to take yourself from being a stream winner to being the arahant. The four ways of becoming stream winner, and then those four ways all come together as making much of the path to become the four arahant. Now the nine charna ground contemplations. Again, monks, as though he were to see a corpse thrown away in a charna ground. This is in those days the bodies could be recycling instead of wasting fuel and burning them, or wasting good agricultural ground by burying them, they just chuck them in the bush. And suppose you see a corpse thrown aside in the bush, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, living and oozing matter. And a monk compares the same body with us. My body too is of the same nature. It will be like this, it will be exempt to that fate. In this way he abides contemplating the body, internally, externally, both internally and externally. And of course this is really internally, externally, this is probably what the original, especially with these asupas. And the arising and passing away, well, either its cause and its cessation, or it's just body, is not seen to be as relevant as the internally, externally of both. Or, that's number one, it's neither of these, or to see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. So it's even more decaying. Or to see a corpse thrown aside in the charnel ground now a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews. Or now flesh with skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews. Or a skeleton without flesh and blood but still held together with sinews. Or disconnected bones scattered in all directions. I won't go through all of the bones here. A corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, the bones all bleached white, the colour of shells. Or bones all heaped up, more than a year old, rotted and crumbled to dust. A bhikkhu compares the same body with this body too is the same age, would be like that, there's no exemption to that fate. So just the various stages of the decay of a body after it dies. And it's because of this that monks, if they're lucky, go and see autopsies. And you do that especially so that you can see a dead body. And instead of actually seeing bodies which are bloated, and I've seen a few of those in my years, that really doesn't really affect you, except for the stench. As like, you know, a body which is just old, which is just died. Because the body which is just died looks just like. And there's nothing more impressive if that person who's died is of the same gender and about the same age. And you see them on the slab. And that really is because of the same age, about the same gender, and you're sitting there, standing there watching, and it really sort of comes home to you that, yeah, as they, so me, as me, so them. That's why we might start going to see autopsies. When we first came to Perth, we could actually go and see those autopsies. We're allowed to get in there. But I think because, especially of Christians, worrying about if you sort of, other people, that body is somehow sacred, that it was always refused. It's just too much trouble for the government. But you can still see them in places like Thailand. And go and see autopsies, people come up. And the first time I went to, as a young monk, I was always told, go on a Monday morning. Because then you get all of the dead bodies from the weekend. You go watch his autopsy. I was actually fascinated by it. It wasn't repulsive. It was just interesting. Because then you have to see the bodies sort of taken apart. And it was just body, that's all. It's a big deal. But what it did actually was show that nothing actually in there.
What if you do a suva practice and it turns to suva after a while? So you wash the corpse and it gets really beautiful.
Okay, that's what happens. Again, just like you say in the four elements, you can master that and it gets boring. You can get into a jhana that way. You can get into a jhana this way. This is interesting, it's very common for people to especially use the skeleton or the bones. And you can see in many monks' huts there may be a skeleton. In my hut, in my room, there's a skull, a real skull. Not a sort of plastic one. And every now and again, Max, there's one over there. Nah, that's my ex now. My ex. And it's there because you can contemplate that. And after a while, it's true, when it fits in your mind, because, you know, it's just a skull, that's all, because of the peace, if you like, the insight going first turns to the the calm, and that becomes like a beautiful nimitta. And it's sort of shy, then you get into the nimitta stage and get into jhana if you want. It's very, very common to do that. Especially some like a skull or other bone. We can do that. So those actually are the satipatthana of the body. And again, you can see what they are. Anapanasati, the postures, the understanding, the awareness, the wisdom of why you're doing these things, and the thoroughness meditations, and then including the nine channel ground contemplation. But each one of these have always this refrain, this is abbreviated here, in this way you abide contemplating the body, internally, externally, or both. Another one's probably added, or else you abide contemplating the body, its cause why it arises, why it ceases. Or abides contemplating the body in its nature of arising and ceasing, understanding the why, the cause, the four nutriments. Or else mindfulness is the body, not me, not mine, or self, is simply established in you, to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness. And thus you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how bhikkhu abides contemplating the body. Now it gets a little bit more simple, with not too many examples, contemplating Vedana. And how amongst does someone contemplate Vedana? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, you understand a pleasant feeling. A painful feeling, you understand a painful feeling. When feeling neither painful nor pleasant feeling, you understand neither painful nor pleasant feeling. That's basically it. So you do this, especially it's just pleasure, it's just pain, it's just beauty, it's just ugliness. Remember, pleasant feelings are in every one of the six senses. And a pleasant feeling and unpleasant feeling have different names according to the senses. So beauty and ugliness is pleasant feeling and painful feeling of sight. Beautiful is ugly. So sound is like sweet, sonorous sound, rasping, grating, discordant sound. That's the pleasant feeling and the painful feeling with the sense of sound. So with the sense of nose or smell, give me examples of pleasant feelings.
Food.
Sorry?
Food
is pleasant. Food is cooking, yes. Sometimes.
Yeah,
no, so yeah, but what's a pleasant feeling? Not always food, because some people have this kimchi, and that stinks. That's not awesome. Exactly. Beauty and ugliness, lovely pleasant sound, unpleasant sound, pleasant smell, unpleasant smell. It is a matter of opinion. Now that's a very great insight. There is no such thing. What about pleasant physical feeling and painful physical feeling? Is that a matter of opinion?
Mm-hmm. Some people
like masochists, yeah?
Bodily pain.
Some people like bodily pain and they get off on it. I think some doctors actually said that physiologically there is no difference in the brain, in the signal, between physical pleasure and physical pain. As I remember saying this, if you look at the sort of neurologist, it's just a strong impulse which comes into the brain. And he said, basically there's no difference there. It's actually our interpretation says this is painful or this is pleasant.
Especially like marathon runners or cyclists. I mean, it's so painful what they're doing, but
they get a high
up. Go through the wall and all this kind of stuff.
No, it's very interesting to know that, because this is actually why we do the contemplation of Vedana. And of course we've got pleasant mental feeling and painful mental feeling. Mm-hmm. You know we add huge amounts onto that. So, it's just pleasant feeling or painful feeling, basically you're just making it up. Or you understand. This gets a little bit more complicated. Feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, an unworldly pleasant feeling, a worldly unpleasant feeling, an unworldly painful feeling, or a worldly neither pleasant nor pleasant, or an unworldly neither pleasant nor pleasant nor pleasant. You know what I'm talking about. That's the word peasant feeling. But anyway, the worldly and unworldly, the unworldly pleasant feelings, you know, the jhanas, inspiration, and then getting sort of high on really good sort of things, being a great thought. That's an unworldly pleasant feeling. Worldly pleasant feelings, you know what those are as well. Just listen to your favourite music, sex, having a joke. That's a worldly pleasant feeling. Worldly painful feelings, you know what they're like. You know, you've got your arthritis. You've got your sort of smell of kimchi or whatever else you like. What's the unworldly painful feeling?
Dukkha vedana.
That's really an interesting one. We don't really need to spend too much time about it, because an unworldly painful feeling is sometimes they like from your striving. You know, you're really trying to find some Dhamma, but it's like hurting, but you know, you're going in the right direction. And the unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling.
But what about some of these insight stages, like where it's a dukkha vedana and you're suppressed by dukkha or something?
That can be good, yeah. It's actually what you add to it, in that sense. In other words, the dukkha leading to the end of dukkha.
But you experience it at that time as an oppressive,
that's right, yeah.
As such an oppressive burden, but
it is, yeah, yeah.
It's a positive thing.
And that's where it's the five senses are unpleasant, but the sixth sense can see it, so it's. That's a good.
But what about when the first jhana starts to suck because you can attain the second jhana?
Good one, yeah. That's an unworldly pleasant feeling. Mm-hmm. Unworldly painful feeling, yeah. I agree with that. So you've got the so called insight here, but this is just, again, not in the Pali, they add these subheadings. In this way, you abide contemplative feeling, internally, externally, or both. Just as you have your Vedana, I have my Vedana, and it's actually the same. Always has some pleasant, some painful, some in between. Or, you abide contemplating feelings, the causes, the cessation, or both. Remember what I said before, what is the cause of Vedana? Contact. When contact ceases, Vedana ceases. So it's a sensory thing, that's all. And because the cause is not you, it's just contact. What that should really mean when you notice this so-called arising and cessation of both is it's out of your control. The cause is not you. So basically, all you're struggling to get rid of pain and out to have pleasure is doomed to failure. All your struggle you cooks to get delicious food which everybody likes is doomed to failure. You try so hard to make a bread pudding and it's all wet underneath. And you tried so hard, you can't do it. That's all it's saying here.
Keep trying.
Possibly not. Give up trying. Face of five. Some people like it, some people don't. Even when you're the cookie, sometimes you don't even like it. So pleasure and pain are out of your control. Beauty, ugliness, nice sound, always getting praise, and sometimes getting criticised. Doesn't matter how hard you work, and people, they just do not appreciate you. How hard you work on that bread pudding, and here's this monk comes along who just says it's too wet, isn't it? Just it's unfair. Okay. Anyway, so that's the whole point here. So it's just see the causes and conditions, why it comes, why it goes. It means it's out of control. Oh, mindfulness that it's just Vedana, for goodness sake. It's not me, not mine, not self. Sometimes it's pleasure, sometimes it's pain, sometimes it's beauty, sometimes it's like this. That's all it is. Not a big thing, it's just part of the world, so stop messing around with it. So when you've got pain, you just cry, I'm hurting, that's just part of life. If you've got pleasure, don't indulge in it. Boy, at last, this is really good. Keep it going. So it's just pleasure, it's just pain, that's all. So that you can abide independent not clinging to anything in this world, especially not clinging to pleasure and pain. Let us have Bhagavad's contemplative feelings. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be free of pleasure and pain? Not to be always searching for pleasure, not to be afraid of pain. That's how you do it. Contemplation of Vedanta. Third Satipatthana, contemplation of the citta. That's what the mind is here about. This really gets interesting. What is the mind? Who are you? What is consciousness? How the Buddha says it here is, could have been done better. I shouldn't really say that, but how amongst does a monk abide contemplating mind? Here someone understands mind affected by lust is affected by lust, affected by hate is affected by hate, affected by delusion is affected by delusion. How do you understand a mind affected by delusion? With a mind affected by delusion?
Inference.
You're deluded.
No, no, by inference you can see desire and ill will, so not a delusion has to use it.
But then, if you can see that, it's not a mind affected by delusion anymore. Yes, right, the old time delay. But it's basically here, you've seen the mind which was affected by delusion. Because when you're deluded, you can't see it.
So, you said only the arahat can see it, or...?
No, the arahat hasn't got delusion anymore.
Yeah, so you can...
Yeah, you can see he was deluded before they came to arahat, yeah, for sure.
But anybody below that can't really see it? Or
they can see it temporarily, but not fully. So when the hindrances are totally overcome, even temporarily, but totally overcome, then there's no delusion. So, now, or you understand a mind contracted, a mind distracted, and exalted, unexalted, surpassed, unsurpassed, concentrated, unconcentrated, liberated, and unliberated. The reason I say it could have been done better here, because the contracted mind, this is interesting, contracted and distracted mind, that is, again, a metaphor. The contracted mind is the mind with stop and torpor. Distracted is a restless mind. That's interesting that they say stop and torpor, it makes your mind very small. Contract the chitta. And that's actually a very interesting perception. That when you have tiredness, it is, you've just got such a small area where you're existing. And the restless, you know, distraction is quite easy, you know. The restless mind, you're always distracted by this and that, you're pulled away so easily. So it's interesting that that's a very, I always like the idea of like contracted for sloth and torpor. And these other ones is exalted, exalted, unsurpassed, concentrated and liberated. It's all explained by the commentary as each one of those meaning the same thing, a mind in jhana, a mind without jhana. The jhana mind and non-jhana mind. Sorry?
So, with what we talk about, being small should be easy to suppress, shouldn't it?
No, because, you know, because you're small as well. Everything is small, so... You can't, you're like stuck in smallness. So it's not as if you're outside of that to be able to pull yourself out. You're right in that smallness. You are contracted. It's a problem. You're right in there with you. But anyway, in this way you contemplate the mind internally, externally, or both. So you just see the nature of the mind. Now the stupid mind with lust, hate and delusion, the one with the sloth and torpor and restlessness. Do you notice here that that's almost like the five hindrances again? The lust is like the first hindrance, the ill will is the second hindrance, the delusion is the fifth hindrance, and you've got this last two, or you know, the third and the fourth, as contracted and distracted. And without the hindrances, the jhana mind. So basically you understand the different types of mind. Now when it comes to, say, contemplating mind in its nature of arising, nature of cessation, or nature of both arising and cessation, that's where it's really nice to go back to this Sanyutta, Satipatthana Sanyutta. With the origination, the arising of Namarupa is the arising of citta, of mind. With the ceasing of Namarupa is the ceasing of mind. Straight away, that shows you that this thing, the citta, in all of its different manifestations, affected by the hindrances or in the jhanas, is just caused by its objects, it vanishes because of its object, vanishes. Namarupa. Straight away, the citta, the mind, consciousness, is seen as impermanent, subject to cessation. It arises from a cause, and the cause disappears, so does your citta. Bye-bye, mind. So, the mind which is seeing this and thinking about this is not you. It's not a person. Comes into being because of course, when the course goes, to disappears. It's just mind. So mindfulness, that it's just mind, that's all. Not me, not mind of itself. It's simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge of mindfulness. So you can abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world, not clinging even to consciousness. You can let consciousness go. Bye-bye mind. Bye-bye consciousness. That is how a monk contemplates mind. You understand, if you do that for 7 days, you will be enlightened or close. Here we go, the contemplation of the Dhamma. And how much does a monk contemplate mind objects? Here it's got Dhamma. Here a monk abides contemplating Dhamma in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a monk abide contemplating Dhamma in terms of the five hindrances? Here there being central desire, the monk understands, there is central desire in me. Or there being no central desire, he understands there is no central desire in me. So you can understand just when you've got lust, when you've got desire, when you haven't. Or you understand how there comes to be the rising of unarisen central desire. In other words, the causes of this. Why do you have lust? Why do you get desire? Why do you have this wanting to experience beauty with your eyes or lovely sounds with your ears? Why do you want this anyway? What's the origin of this? Craving is, but I would say it's most important, especially in meditation, is discontent. You're not happy where you are. So you want to sort of fill that gap, that void, that hole with some sort of sense of desire. And when there is so you also understand how the abandoning of unarisen sensual desire comes to be. In other words, if you've got sensual desire, how do you get rid of it? And how there comes to be a future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. Being ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, there being doubt in you. A monk understands there's doubt in me. Or there being no doubt, you understand there's no doubt, understands how doubt comes to be, how it disappears, and when it's disappeared, how it doesn't come up again. Now remember, in each one of these, there has the prequel is mindful, fully aware, ardent, having put away the five hindrances. They say, when the sensual desiring, you know the sensual desiring. In other words, having put away the five hindrances, when there's five hindrances there, you can see them. Again, in each one of these mindfulness, it's not always mind for the moment, it's actually reflecting back on what was happening. Because really, when you've got the five hindrances, you can't really see those five hindrances. The five hindrances are deluding. So when you have lust, you just can't understand it. This evening there was a call from a woman in the Dalai Lama service about her relationship with her husband who'd been cheating on her for the last year. She really upset him. He said, look, when your husband was cheating on you, he didn't know that he was cheating on you. That was a sort of strange thing to say. He knew it, but he didn't understand it. He had lust. didn't have wisdom. The hindrances were deluding him. That's why when you have lust, you think it's okay. You just don't see straight. So you have ill will. You're stupid, you don't see straight. You do stupid things. So when there's these five hindrances, it actually stops you being wise. So the only way you can actually wisely contemplate these five hindrances is in retrospect, once they've disappeared.
Not while
you're in lust. When you're in lust, you just can't understand it. That's why people, when they have got lust, they can cheat on their partner. When you're in ill will, you can't understand ill will. And you can do things which put you in jail for years afterwards. You lose it. Afterwards, when you see what you've done, then you make strategy so you don't get into that state again. In other words, you sort of start practicing things like Eightfold Path, becoming wise, becoming more aware, more reflective, so you don't allow those unarisen hindrances actually to get into you. So for example, if you're a man, you do see a beautiful girl, you turn your eyes away, you stop, it's going to create lust in you, don't look at them, or do some of the super practices, or whatever. If you see some beautiful food, the stuff you really like, chocolate cake, you know you're not allowed to have chocolate cake. What should I do? Then you have to do some sort of contemplation before it gets too strong. Just like, you know what I do, you see that chocolate cake is brown, what comes out the other end is brown. So when you look at that feces, it must have come from somewhere. If you look at it, actually it's in that cake somewhere. That cake is feces, but something else on top of it, because you take that energy, that nutrient out, and what's left is the feces. So the feces is actually in that cake. So if you do that, it takes away a lot of your hunger. That's how you do it, how you get rid of these desires and lust. So when you eat tomorrow morning, just contemplate, you know, where do the feces come from? They come from right there, in your bowl of food. That's actually got it in there, it's in there somewhere. All covered up with the things that make it look nice. It's in there. It has to be in there. Can't come from anywhere else.
But that word suppression, I've used that's not suppression. How you guys do it is not suppression.
No, it's actually just a bit of understanding. So
yeah, it's suppression.
A suppression is through willpower. That never works. I am not going to have lust. I am not going to be. I'm not going to sort of be greedy.
Yeah,
what happens? You're greedy. You say, that wasn't me. That's me. I didn't do that. You hide it then. Well, it's not suppressed through will. Suppressed through wisdom by doing things like this. And really, suppressing through wisdom is not really suppressing. Suppressing gritting your teeth and just using willpower. That's not really what it's all about. I better get going, otherwise we'll be here till tomorrow morning, and then you really have the hindrances soften to open their will towards me. So that's on page 151, page 152. In this way, you abide contemplating these objects in their internal, external, or both. This is, you have these, we all have these, this is just hindrances, that's all. Or else you abide contemplating these hindrances, how they are caused, where they go to, why they're there. The nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else mindfulness is just hindrances, that's all. They're just mind objects. Establish necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. You abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a monk abides contemplating mind objects, and mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. Now, look at this where it says, they're just hindrances, that's all. What does that mean? You make peace, be kind, be gentle with them. It's hindrances. Not my hindrances. Not my problem. The next time you have sloth and torpor, nothing to do with me. Not my problem. Just sloth and torpor, that's it. Next time you have lust, nothing to do with me. If you can do that, they vanish. All of these hindrances, they're all built up on you doing something, controlling, owning things. This is actually one of the best ways of so-called wise suppression. Nothing to do with me.
If you do it right,
straight away, or? Pretty much, no, it's not straight away, because it's the result of all karma. So making good karma, they're just vanished slowly. When the old karma is all worn out, then no new lust, no new ill will, no new stop and torpor, all that sort of stuff. The five aggregates. Again, monks, a monk abides contemplating mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging, the five khandhas. And how does a monk abide contemplating the five aggregates? If a monk understands such is material form, such is origin, its disappearance, such is feeling, its origin, its disappearance, perception, its origin, its disappearance, formation, its origin, disappearance, consciousness, its origin, disappearance. In other words, not only know these things, you know where they come from and why they disappear. If you know that they are cause for something, when the cause disappears, so does body disappear, so does feeling disappear, so does perception disappear, so does will disappear, one of the mental formations, so does consciousness disappear. So you contemplate it in this way, so you can see there's nothing substantial there. The Buddha described these things in great similes. He said, just like you can watch the Ganges River, he says, in flood you can see foam on the surface. And foam on the surface of a river. Something you see here actually when you have the rains. Sometimes there's lots of foam on these sort of rivulets and streams. But that's just like the body. It's just insubstantial, nothing in there, just like a series of bubbles held together. That's the body, like foam on the Ganges, that's all it is. And Vedana, I mentioned that the other day, that's like the raindrop on a puddle, and it plop and it disappears. So that's Vedana, just pleasure pain just goes so quickly. Just a pop, that's all. Under the beautiful pop, sometimes an ugly pop, it's gone. So that's how you can contemplate the arising and passing away of Vedana. Or perception. That's where the Buddha called perception the mirage. Where you add onto reality things which it doesn't deserve. Or seeing a rainbow. It's just the play of light, it's not something solid. That's all it is. So the perceptions, we add so much onto things. And mental formations. Will. But I prefer Bhante's description, because a plantain is a banana tree. And as a Westerner, he didn't really know banana trees. The point was, a banana tree was just a lump of leaves, there's no heartwood to it. Mm. So the onion of Bhante's, you peel an onion, and there's nothing there, it's just again leaves. There's not no hard core there, or kernel. Just like these mental formations, like will. You peel it, you understand, there's no self in there, there's no me in the centre of will.
What's really nice here about is the grass trees.
Yeah, nothing in there either.
Nothing at all. Yeah.
But the onion is a very good simile, because when you peel it, it does make you cry. So that has the dukkha aspect of contemplating the fourth. And his joke was an onion. It goes on and on with an eye in the middle. Now, on, eye, on. Onion. So the very good pair of words for that is it goes on and on with an eye in the middle, that's the onion. Nothing substantial in it and it makes you cry. That's will. It makes you cry. That's a very brilliant sort of analogy, much better than the plantain tree. And the consciousness. And that was a magician's trick. Let's sing with the Buddha. This consciousness, knowing things, is a trick, a fantasy. It's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. It's like pulling a self out of consciousness. It's just an illusion, that's all. So that's the Buddha's simile, so the five counts. So let's see how we contemplate the things. In this way, you're by contemplating the mind objects as mind objects, internally, externally, imposed. Or they're arising, passing away, or both. Or else, you just know it's just aggregates, that's all. not me, not mine, the self. It's just consciousness doing its thing. Sankara is doing their thing, not my thing. And that is how you abide Sandipati mind objects in terms of the five aggregates. Now, in most of the ancient Satipatthanas, that's where it finished. There was no other, no six bases, no seven enlightenment factors, no Four Noble Truths, that was it. That's the original. So these ones have been added. There's nothing wrong with these being added. But it's nice to know this wasn't in the original. Again, monk abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of six internal and external bases. How does a monk contemplating mind objects in terms of the internal and external bases? You understand the eye and forms, and the effect that arises depending on both. In other words, when you like what you see. You understand how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, again, because of desire, how there comes to be the abandoning of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to, that's by the Eightfold Path. And how there comes to be the future not arising of the abandoned fetter. You understand ear and sounds, nose and odours, tongue and flavours, body and tangibles, mind and mind objects. The fetter arises dependent on both, and how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future not arising of the abandoned fetter. In this way you contemplate mind objects, internally and externally, both internally and externally. My six senses are pretty much the same as your six senses. And you abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. It's just senses, that's all. Nothing else. All the seven enlightenment factors. Oh, actually, I made a mistake there. In the original, there was just the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. The five aggregates, the six bases, and four noble truths of what was added. Again, monks and monk abides contemplating mind objects in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. How does he do this? Here, there being the mindfulness enlightenment factor, you understand it's a mindfulness enlightenment factor. There being no mindfulness, you understand there's no mindfulness. In other words, you understand there was no mindfulness. There, you understand how mindfulness comes to rise, and how the original mindfulness enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. You understand investigation of states, of the Dhamma Vichaya, energy, rapture, tranquility, stillness, and equanimity, the seven enlightenment factors. They're called enlightenment factors because they lead to enlightenment, but they also describe the experience of enlightenment too. So you understand? So yes?
Why is here there not sukha?
Aha.
So much very refined.
Because the it is, no, it's not more refined, it is implied in the tranquility. Because in most of the series, they say that from piti there is pasadi, the tranquility. From tranquility there is sukha. From sukha there is samadhi. So it's almost implied there, because there's also a series here, one leading to the other of the enlightenment factors, and that's actually in the Bhojanga Sanyutta, how one leads to the other. And that's a common causal sequence. Once rapture is, well, like happiness, a sort of physical type happiness, if you like. And I won't sort of stick to that totally. Once that is generated in you, then it's very easy to be tranquil, bodily and mental. Without happiness, it's so hard to actually to sit still and have a still mind. Once the mind is still, then you get the happiness. From that happiness, from physical stillness, you get happiness, and from that you get the stillness of the mind, of samadhi. And from samadhi you see things as they truly are, and then you are equanimous. So you understand these things. In this way you can abide contemplating the Dhamma as Dhamma, internally, externally, both internally and externally, you see the rising, passing away. Both the rising, passing away. It's just enlightenment practice, that's all. It's just and that's something which arises in the mind. That is how Michael Bard's contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of seven enlightenment factors, or the Four Noble Truths. You can contemplate mind objects in terms of Four Noble Truths. You understand this is suffering, you understand the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way it leads to cessation of suffering. In this way, you abide contemplating mind objects, internally, externally, or both, or contemplating mind objects in their arising, passing away, or both, or else mind is just mind objects. Dhammas, that's all. To the extent necessary for bare knowledge of mindfulness, so you abide independent and clinging to nothing in the world. That's how mind contemplates mind objects. Now, I never went to too much detail here on the cause of the mind objects, according to the Satipatthana Sanghita. Now, this is something a bit more original, which actually gets you very close to the meaning of this fourth Satipatthana. So what is the arising of the fourth Satipatthana, the mind objects? This is where it has attention. With the origin of attention, there is the origination of dhammas. The cessation of attention, there is the cessation of these dhammas, of the Satipatthana. Now that gets it very, very clear. The attention is the cause of these Satipatthanas. They've got a little note there, remember, there's something important in that note. The commentary to this says, the phenomena of the enlightenment factors, the dhamma of the enlightenment factors, originate through careful attention. The phenomena of the hindrance through careless attention.
Unwise or wise.
The yoni samadhi seeker or ajoni samadhi seeker. Now that opens up a nice understanding of what this original Satipatthana would have been. Basically, understanding the arising sort of the dhammas, especially in terms of the enlightenment factors, enlightenment, hindrances, stupidity, illusion. So the whole purpose was there, was how to become enlightened, how not become enlightened. And to see that through attention, see it's arising and cessation, if that sort of attention is wise attention, the enlightenment factors arise. If it's unwise attention, hindrances arise. Very beautiful part of that fourth Satipatthana. It only comes when you actually know enough sutras, you can put them together. You combine the fact that then the meanings will start to expand. And once you understand that attention, obviously you've got a means to get enlightened now. Don't pay attention to things which give rise to hindrances. Attention, good attention which gives rise to enlightenment factors. So here we go with the conclusion. Monks, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 7 years, one or two fruits could be expected for them. Either final knowledge here and now, that's arahat, or if there's a trace of clinging left, anagama. Trace of clinging to what? Basically the mental happiness. That's what the teachers are not saying. Mental happiness. So you get born where you find happiness in terms of the mind of the jhanas or the other groups.
That means you to be without the five hindrances for 7 years.
Yep.
Like all the time.
Yep. Let alone 7 years, that's not so hard to be really into jhanas. They get into them, they can actually maintain it for a long time. Let alone 7 years. If I should develop the four foundation mindfulness for 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 year, and let alone 1 year, for 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month, let alone half a month, for just 7 days. Now you would ask in English, why did he just say for 7 years, or just 7 days to start off with? Why do you have to go 7 years, 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, half a 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month, 7 days. Pali loves repetition. And summarizes it and repeats again and again and again. And for a Westerner, it just gets ad nauseum. But for in India, maybe because they didn't have so many things to listen to, so many books to read, so many tapes to listen to, just listen to something is probably very nice. But in the end, it comes down to 7 days.
It makes a difference whether you're reciting or reading.
It does indeed too, because when you're reciting, it becomes this repetition, which becomes quite sonorous, and actually leads you in and makes you quite peaceful.
And if you can't make it in 7 days, you don't think you're done. You think, okay, I've got another chance. Okay.
You did another chance. But the important thing is, it's such a way. So if you practice Satipatthana, you're not in line for 7 days, it's nothing wrong with the Satipatthana. It's nothing wrong with you. If the thing doesn't work, read the instructions. What have you done wrong? So you read instructions in such a way. That's somehow or other, you haven't done it in that way. And one of the most particular ones is you haven't let go of the five senses.
I think somewhere in the commentary it says, if the mind has a false jala and dwells in the forest, and if there's a wound in it, then the jalas are gone. And
Of course not. Because if you're in a forest and you've got four jhanas, you're just so blissed out, you just don't hear that stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, if he has come out, those jhanas.
He'll come out, he's still got the.
You won't keep him from
saying to that. So that's just from the Nārakapāna Sutta, the hindrances do not invade the mind of the main for a long time. That's been a long time after.
So it's easy to keep it up
for 7 years. Indeed. You can still be liable to sort of fall away, but it's not that easy to fall away. So it was reference to this that it was said, monks, this is a direct path. In other words, a path that leads in one way. If you do this properly, it has to lead to enlightenment. Direct path, the purification of beings, the surmounting of sorrow, lamentation, disappearance of pain, grief, the attainment of the true way, for the realization of nirvana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. This is what the Blessed One said. And the monks, hopefully the only characters, amen, lay women, were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. You've read that before, and hopefully you've heard some things you've never heard before. Otherwise, it'd be a waste of time you're giving these talks.
And so it's kind of like in a menu. You pick four practices out, and that would be enough. You don't have to do all the practices for the different foundations.
Oh, interesting. One of them will be enough. You say even the Anapanasati is enough to lead you to full enlightenment.
But in there it's just the first part of the
Yes, yes.
The higher part.
It's the white you get started, like snowball rolling down here. You get started and something just goes by itself. Well, as you said, the Ajahn Dhan with the elements. So they just get into voidness. So you contact the skull and mimics come up and you as you walk. Sometimes with the path it's just getting it started. Getting the ball rolling. And then you're finding your life, it just carries on by itself, you can't stop it. Insights just come through you, and stillness just happens. And you're rolling along, hardly any effort. You're just getting it going is the problem. It's just like starting your car. I remember my father, those old enough, had these old cars, these old Fords, and had to, that's right, put the cranks in and just get it going and keep going and going. I was only a kid, I tried that, I was just not strong enough to do that. But once it's going, it's fine. You get in there quickly and off you go. Yeah? Okay. That's just the part. Crank it up and then you're off. Okay, so that's the Satipatthana number 10, and next week will be number 1.